This is Dave Gahary on the corner of Wall and Fraud. On January 9th of this year, at a press conference held by the Commission on Public Trust and Private Enterprise, held at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York City, I read the following question to the Blue Ribbon panel assembled there to update the public on their progress in cleaning up corporate America. It can be argued that the tone of corporate America is set, at least partially, by the New York Stock Exchange, the private, quasi-governmental, self-regulating organization whose lax listing and other standards have allowed certain corporations access to the capital markets. The New York Stock Exchange's history of self-regulatory scandal is well documented, yet the Commission makes little mention of the exchange's involvement in, and perhaps enabling of, the recent corporate crime wave. Would it not make sense to more closely examine the New York Stock Exchange's listing standards and their role, if any, in contributing to these recent series of scandals? Additionally, as the current head of the New York Stock Exchange, Richard Grasso, holds the titles chairman and CEO and sits on the board of at least one NYSE-listed company, will the exchange be expected to abide by the Commission's recommendations? Late last month, the New York Stock Exchange, headed by Chairman and CEO Dick Grasso, attempted to fill a vacant public board seat by nominating Sandy Weill, head of Citigroup, one of the firms found to have defrauded the public with overly optimistic research reports. A public furor followed, and Chairman Dick Grasso decided not to submit Sandy Weill's name for consideration. To help us clear the air on this matter and to discuss the New York Stock Exchange's corporate governance history further is Ben Steele. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations here in New York City. Ben, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning. Ben, could you explain a little bit for our listeners, what is a senior fellow and what is the Council on Foreign Relations?
The Council on Foreign Relations is a nonprofit membership association. It has about 4,000 members, and it's also what's known as a think tank. It's a research institute. It's completely nonpartisan. The institute as such does not have any views on any issue of public policy, although, as you know well, Dave, from being there, those of us who do work there certainly do have our own individual views on all sorts of subjects related to the operation of U.S. foreign policy, financial markets, and so on.
Right, Ben. Now, the Council on Foreign Relations, that was organized in, 1921?
Yes.
And this entity is one that certain people who might be considered conspiracy theorists consider it to be. I mean, isn't that something that's true?
The popular perception is really all over the map. Some associate the council with vast right-wing global conspiracies. Others associate it with left-wing conspiracies, you know, trying to bring the UN to run the world through black helicopters. I can assure you, Dave, that it's not nearly so sinister. The members of the council do not, in any sense, make policy at the council. They come to hear outside speakers and participate in the study groups at the councils. As for the research institute side that I'm involved in, we don't take any direction from the members, from donors, or anybody like that.
Right.
In fact. If any organization tries to donate money to the council to support research and claims contractually any form of editorial control over the output, the council will reject it as a matter of policy. So it is scrupulously independent.
Okay, and it says here from the website, www.cfr.org, the Council on Foreign Relations, Inc., is a nonprofit and nonpartisan organization devoted to promoting improved understanding of international affairs through the free exchange of ideas. The council takes no institutional position on policy issues and has no affiliation with the U.S. government. And the publication that is put out by the council is what, Ben?
It's called Foreign Affairs. It's the world's leading journal of foreign policy.
Okay. And you, on that website, says you're the acting director of the Maurice R. Greenberg Center for Geoeconomic Studies. And is that a relatively new...
Yes, that was founded about a year ago. The premise behind it was that economics was becoming more important in the operation of U.S. foreign policy, and that the Council should ensure that its research was properly informed by economic knowledge. And that's why the center was created.
I see. And you are, according to this website, well, first of all, you have your PhD from Oxford University, and that is, well, you have your BS from there, and you also and master's and PhD in economics, and the Wharton School, of course, as University of Pennsylvania, international finance and economics expert specializing in securities trading, financial market regulation, and risk management, and you're also a founding partner of an organization called Efficient Frontiers.
That's right.
What's that about?
On a part-time basis, I do consulting for stock exchanges and securities firms and governments around the world.
Okay. And that's that website is what for Efficient?
www.efficientfrontiers.com.
Okay, that's easy. Now, you said you do consulting for stock exchanges.
That's right.
Yeah, what happened with our own New York Stock Exchange?
Well, as you can imagine, Dave, I don't do terribly much consulting for the New York Stock Exchange.
Yeah.
Although
they did try to hire you, didn't they?
That's true. I did get a solicitation two years back. But as you know, the exchange seems to have a policy of better to have the bastard inside R10 pissing out than outside pissing in. But I'm quite happy with my current employment, Dave.
Right. Okay. So what happened with the NYSE? Grasso had attempted to nominate Sandy Weill.
Yeah, NYSE has for many years had a soft spot, as it were, politically, which is its corporate governance, as you identified. A year ago, they tried to put themselves out at the forefront of the corporate governance debate in response to all those instances of corporate malfeasance involving a number of their own listed companies, Enron in particular, by imposing new governance requirements for their listed companies.
Right.
And the most important component of those new requirements was the one that said that a majority of directors of their listed company board should be quote-unquote independent. And let me tell you, Dave, if I may, what the definition of independence is.
Please.
Okay. The NYSE specifies that for a director to be independent, the board must affirmatively determine that the director has no material relationship with the company, either directly or as a partner, stockholder, or officer of an organization that has a relationship with the company. Okay, and the exchange says that a majority of such board members should fit that definition of independence. So given that the New York Stock Exchange is itself a private organization, it is owned by broker-dealer members,
right.
I decided to investigate how closely the board of the New York Stock Exchange meets its own new proposed standards. And I was rather surprised, Dave, to find that they don't even come close.
Wow. When did you begin this investigation?
Shortly after the NYSE announced its new standards last spring. Didn't take much to do the research, Dave. You know, you can find the names of the board members of the New York Stock Exchange on their website.
Right. Right, that's right. But you've been on this matter for quite some time now. I mean, you had a piece in November, and this was from your research then in the Investment Dealer's Digest. NYSE board policy slammed economists as Grasso, other NYSE execs violating their own proposed policy.
Yeah, that was based on an article I'd written in Securities Industry News
right.
over the summer on August 19th called NYSE to Corporate America, Do As I Say, Not As I Do.
Right, and why do you think it is that the New York Stock Exchange feels that they could propose listing standards for the companies that are on their exchange and not abide by those rules themselves.
Well, let me tell you first, Dave, about the actual composition of the boards in New York Stock Exchange.
Great.
At the time I wrote the article, it hasn't changed very much. They had 29 members, the board.
29, okay.
Okay. Three of them are New York Stock Exchange executives.
Right.
Grasso, Robert Britz, and Catherine Kinney, so they can't be independent.
Right.
21 of them are representatives of NYSE member firms, listed firms, or both. Okay, they can't possibly fit the NYSE.
So that's 25 so far out of 29.
We're right now up to 24 out of 29. So we're left with five who are potentially independent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of those five, you've got a few politicos there, like Leon Panetta and Carl McCall. But you go through the others and you find rather interesting connections. For example, Larry Sonsini is managing partner of a law firm, which according to law.com did more IPOs as issuer's counsel than any other firm nationally for the past 3 years running. So Larry Sonsini cannot possibly, by the NYSE's own definition of independence, be an independent director.
Right.
Why? Because obviously he has a strong commercial interest in seeing that the listing standards are such, meaning low enough, that he can do a lot of IPOs on the exchange.
Right.
So, as you can see, virtually none of these members of the board fit the NYSE's definition of independence. Now, why is this a problem?
Right.
As we said earlier, the NYSE is a private membership organization controlled entirely by market intermediaries. These are broker-dealers and specialists who have a strong interest, obviously, in making money from the operations of the exchange.
Right.
That can include things, for example, like controlling how trading takes place on the floor. And as you can imagine, investors have a very strong interest in the way that trading takes place. And if the board is being directed by individuals who have a different interest in maximizing their own brokerage profits, often at the expense of investor trading profits, then you've got a real conflict. And that conflict is very visible day in, day out, particularly for institutional investors, Dave,
right,
who are constantly complaining both to the NYSE and the SEC that the trading rules governing how transactions occur on the floor of the exchange are very unfair to their fund holders and biased in favor of the specialist and the floor brokers.
Right. You know, I'm just surprised that such an organization exists in this day and age with the electronic alternatives available. Why do you think it is, Ben, that the New York Stock Exchange, with its open outcry system, is allowed to exist today?
Well, it exists because it serves the interest of its members very well. As you remember, Dave, back in 1999, Dick Grasso said that the exchange was going to, quote-unquote, demutualize and become a public listed company. In fact, that we would all be able to buy and sell shares of the New York Stock Exchange on the New York Stock Exchange by Thanksgiving 1999. But the member firms made it absolutely clear to him that that was never going to happen. He would never get the votes through the board. Why? Because the way trading takes place on the New York Stock Exchange is extremely profitable to the floor brokers and particularly the specialist firms that operate down there. They know perfectly well that if the exchange were to demutualize and be owned and governed by outsiders, folks like you and me,
right,
that there's no way that that floor would survive, because the floor does not maximize the profits of the exchange itself as a self-standing entity. It's the utility to maximize the brokerage profits of the members. Now, let's say, Dave, that the exchange did demutualize, okay, and become a public company with a diversified shareholder base.
Okay.
What would they be interested in? Well, they'd be interested in eliminating all costs of trading on the exchange that don't accrue to them as a company. In other words, if trading costs are accruing to brokers to put orders through the exchange, they'd want to eliminate that. they'd want an electronic system that would cut out as many intermediaries as possible to maximize their own profits.
Okay, but I see.
But that's not how the exchange runs. If you look around the world, particularly to Europe these days, Dave, you see that virtually all exchanges use some form of what's called an electronic continuous auction system. These systems involve very little intermediation, and they have what's called strict price time priority. That sounds technical, Dave, but it's really simple. Let me explain to your listeners what it means. And what it means that the New York Stock Exchange did not have this. You know, there are two types of orders in the market, Dave, limit orders and market orders. A limit order trader says, I'd be willing to buy or sell so many shares of this stock at such and such a price or better. A market order trader says, I want to buy or sell now. Give me the best price in the market. If the market has what's called price-time priority, if you have the most aggressive limit order out there, there may be others matching you, but yours was placed first, so you have price and time priority. Nobody can step in front of you. That means when a market order comes down, it matches against your limit order and you execute. That's not how the New York Stock Exchange runs, Dave. Okay, if you've got the best limit order on the specialist order book, that information is free information to the floor brokers to tell them how supply and demand is changing in the market. And they can step in front of those orders by improving the price by a penny. It's known as penny jumping, making a trivial improvement to the price of the limit order, basically using that information for free and buying the stock for their clients rather than the investor that sent down that limit order. So what happens is that the investor sent down the limit order to the specialist order book. He never gets executed, and in fact, the price of the stock moves away from him. So the situation is even worse than before he put the order down there. As you can imagine, institutional investors who trade in very large stock hate this system, but the New York Stock Exchange won't change it because the member firms love it.
Unbelievable. Ben, we're going to have you come back here and explain more fully about this particular subject, because it is something that is of great interest to myself and to the listeners. And, Ben, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Ben.